Our guest today is somebody who I wish had been my number one on the podcast, because it's a man I've wanted to speak to for so long, and I'm just profoundly excited that we have a new book out, and therefore here he is sitting opposite me, and I'm very happy that you are here. Mo Gordat. You will know him either as the author of four books, this is your fourth book, of the chief business officer at Google, of having been involved in 20 tech businesses and your own agency, and a mission to make 1 billion people less stressed.
And happy.
And happy. Yeah. So worry, fear, panic, and anxiety too can be studied algorithmically. When we understand the parameters that magnify them, we learn how to address them. Mo has a unique way of breaking down the notions of worry, panic, anxiety, and of course, fear. In his first few books, he's conquered happiness, and with his upcoming book, Unstressable, he's on a mission to take 1 million people out of stress and 1 billion people happy. That's the 1 billion people happy. How far do you think you are in that journey? Because that your happiness book was 2017.
First of all, thank you for having me. And that's, you know, the book is Unstressable, and I think the introduction makes me a little stressed. I have to be up to your expectations. But happiness, the mission started with 10 million, and 10 million happened in 8 weeks, believe it or not.
How do you measure it?
We measure two components. One is that people received the message. Mm-hmm. The message reminded them that happiness is their birthright and happiness is attainable. You mm-hmm. see, there are two challenges with happiness. One is that we believe it's you know, secondary. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, success is more important, that acceptance of people and our fit, you know, to fit in society is more important. So we put happiness third or fourth or fifth in our life. And the first thing to do is to send a message that says, no, it's not. Happiness is a prerequisite to success. It's a prerequisite to good relationships, you know, and so on. Mm-hmm. But also to remind people that it's very attainable, because most people, with years and years and years of feeling unhappy, they start to accept that unhappiness is the way it should be, that it's a small tax to pay for all of the other gain in life. Mm-hmm. And so the first component of 1 billion happy is to get you to the message that says, hold on, I actually deserve to be happy and there is a way to get there. Mm-hmm. The second component is that you engage, you take action. So we want to measure either you taking action yourself, so you invest in yourself, you mm-hmm. go and see more content, you try to read a book, you try to, you know, practice something and so on. So either that, or you invest in others. Mm-hmm. So you basically have the compassion to make another person happy. And what that means is that you you share the video with someone, or you you know, you buy the book and give it to someone and so on. So we stopped measuring accurately post 50 million. I have to say, and it's not you know, it is quite interesting, because it's a question of time. Mm-hmm. It's not a question of if it will happen. When something reaches that scale of millions, you know, I never in my life ever expected that I will get to a billion happy. But if you get tens of millions of people that can understand the concept that changes their life about happiness, they will keep teaching it to their kids. They will keep teaching it to their
and
best friends.
And it's a multiple which will get there.
And sooner or later, you know, my original calculation, believe it or not, when the mission came out was 70 years. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to live that long, but it seems to be faster than the original calculation.
I'm sure you're keeping a check of the calculation and of the years.
I know.
So if you check on the calculation and the years and that spread and how it's changed, how many years ahead are you?
There is one of two ways you can look at it. One is a linear chart. Mm-hmm. And we're very far, so we're maybe 10% of the way, right? But if you understand how you know, exponential functions work,
and it accelerates
the doubling function of this, we could be 2 to 3 doublings away.
Yeah.
You know, if you imagine just hypothetically that we have 100 people today that have that message, mm-hmm. and each of them tells 2 people, then next year you're going to have 300 people, and then if each of those tells 2 people, you know, then we're in a very, very good place. We're going to be at 900 people. Mm-hmm. And then one more doubling and you're done. You're at 1,000, right? Okay. So it is possible. It is possible. And it's, remember, I'm not saying that 1 billion happy will make a billion people happy. I'm saying 1 billion happy will change the mindset of a billion people mm-hmm. to do the work and have the tools that they need to become happy.
And to therefore reverberate around them a different attitude, which then
changes everything.
I want to go, not back, but I want to just, this is about being fearless. The podcast is about hearing stories that make people fearless. And I want to ask you two things. Firstly, could you have written Unstressable if you hadn't written?
Not at all.
No. So one comes in a way before the other. Do you believe that the idea to understand how you can be happy is a really important thing to do before you look at how you can live a life without letting stress kill it?
It's quite interesting because when I wrote Solve for Happy, I lived one of the most stressful lives on the planet. And, you know, I was chief business officer of Google X. I had just lost my son. And, you know, my marriage was getting to a very difficult patch. You know, when you lose a child, it becomes even more exaggerated. And I was writing and working full time at the mm-hmm. same time, on top of supervising all of my investments and all of my, you know, startups that I was coaching and so on. And yet I was happy. By my definition of happy, I was very happy.
So you had worked on the philosophy of this concept of happiness
for years.
Before Ali died, before your son died.
Yeah, Ali is the one that taught me about the philosophy, right? I tend to have a very reasonably feminine, emotional, intuitive view of life. Mm-hmm. But as you can hear from my voice and my beard, and, you know, I'm a Middle Eastern man raised very masculine and so on and so forth. And it seems to me that in my younger years, I depended a lot more on that analytical, linear, push through type approach mm-hmm. to life. And my son Ali Habibi was the heart, really. So he would be the one that reminds me that all that pops up in my head, all of those complex algorithms, all of the logical processes that are so accurate in their description mm-hmm. are also felt in the heart. And of course, you can never find happiness unless you have that balance. Mm-hmm. And so Ali was truly the teacher, if you want. Okay, the supervisor, the sage that I would go to and explain what I found in life, and then he would explain it to me in a way that the heart would understand.
This happened from what age?
You'll be shocked. I have photos of me and Ali sitting on the beach when he was three. And, you know, one of my favorite photos of all time is a picture of me and him from behind. We're unaware that we're being photographed. And you can easily see that we're engaged in a very deep conversation.
Was he an old soul?
Very much so. Mm. Very much so. And he spoke very little. Even at that age, he spoke very, very little. He was laughing all the time and joking all the time. But when it was an important topic, he would really speak 8 words at the end of an hour, right? Mm-hmm. And those 8 words would change your life. Mm. And I think most of our kids do that. We just don't listen. You know, Hannah, my wife and I now, we're just talking today, that it seems that we come to this world enlightened. We are fearless. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you studied, behaviorism, a child is completely fearless. Mm-hmm. You're presented with a snake or a puppy, it doesn't know the difference. Mm-hmm. It's not afraid of anything. Happy all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, children are by definition, if you feed them and keep them safe and warm, they're laughing and giggling and playing with their toes, right? They are open, they're loving, they are intuitive, they're playful, they're fun, right? And then we go out of that. We go out of that. We force our children out of that. We simply tell them, this won't get you far in life. You have to do differently.
Did you do that with Ali?
Not at all. I think neither Ali nor I, my daughter, I think what ended up happening is I was at awe by their genius. And I was simply in my very highly pressuring executive life. I was sort of looking at them and saying, there is something I could learn here. Mm-hmm. This is how life should be. And believe it or not, you know, in my later years, chief business officer of Google X is like a very big title, but mm-hmm. I was the biggest kid you could ever meet. I was very, very, very chill. I was the one that goes to my sales teams and say, sell less. Why are you doing this?
I get a sense that at some stage you were pressurized because you describe this event where I think you always describe Ali as very sage, but your daughter as this jack-in-a-box. And, you know, there was a day when she was like, la-la-la, and you were like, later. Or, you know, there was something and it made you go start with yourself of, have I just taken from her this? You know, there's that moment.
Yeah. I think they were both wisdom in the opposite views of wisdom. Mm-hmm. So if you looked at wisdom from both sides, Ali was that Zen monk. Mm-hmm. Zen monk that basically said, life is so simple, don't overcomplicate it. Aya was life itself. Aya still is life itself. Aya basically looks at, remember, the wisest people you will ever meet. And I had the privilege of meeting the wisest people and the most enlightened people since I wrote about happiness. They're kids. Mm-hmm. They truly are. Mm-hmm. You know, they truly get to the point where they figure life out so much that they realize that this is just a game. Mm. This is just, we're here to flow with the gameplay. So you can see the both sides of them. And I, you know, Ali, because of his wisdom, almost always treated me like the kid. So he would be the one that, if I am a little nervous, I mean, I remember, I still have it. I think he was 8 or 9 or something like that. And he, as a birthday gift, he got me the black Angry Bird, mm-hmm. soft toy. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I was like, oh, that's really nice. Why did you pick this one? And he looked at me and he didn't say anything. I said, Ali, seriously, why did you pick this one? He says, it reminds me a bit of you. Okay. That's an 8-year-old's way of telling me, you're too mm-hmm. tightly wound and you're really explosive and you're so angry at life somehow, mm-hmm. right? And when you really, really look at them, I remember vividly, of course, the turning point in my life was not Ali. It was Aya when she was 5. You know, acting like a child and jumping up and down and, you know, popping into my office on a Saturday morning, so excited about life. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, oh, we're going to go play in the playground and then we can have popcorn and can we have ice cream as well? And she's so happy. Mm-hmm. And I was the one that looked at her and said, can we please be serious for a minute? Mm. What serious? She was 5. She was 5, right? And I could see with my eyes as her heart broke. And I think that moment was really the moment where I figured out what matters. Because you and I know, most people don't know that, but you and I know that success in life is not just the result of how hard you worked, right? Mm. That life comes in every now and then and offers you a very interesting, like, hey, take this one, it's gonna help you, right? And most of the time we don't influence that moment at all. As a matter of fact, the only reason you and I are sitting now is because of how life changed the direction of my life, mm-hmm. right? The only reason I even joined Google at all was a total stroke of luck, right? I worked hard after that stroke of luck, but mm-hmm. you know, without it, I would have never been at Google. And you have to start thinking of life that way. When Aya started to cry in front of me, I was suddenly I was like, I don't want to be that person.
Yeah.
Why am I doing this? I mean, again, remember, I'm born and raised in Egypt, public school, public university in Egypt. I shouldn't be sitting in front of you, honestly. And you know, that constant blessing came into my life, I have no idea why. Like, my ultimate dream when I finished university was to have a carpentry workshop. And somehow life takes me from that to IBM, to Microsoft, to Google, you know, gives me all of the chances that, and at the end of the day, anyone in my place will go like, yeah, I'm self-made. I made it. You know, I was clever and I worked hard. Crap. Total crap. Total crap. And I promise you, everyone that tells you that is lying to themselves.
Well, I think that people say a mixture. You know, if I look at myself today, I think I'm here because I'm hungry. I want to keep moving and learning. I have ambition is a very broad way to say it, but I want to influence and help quite a few people, not with happiness, but just to feel good about themselves. Similar, 100%. Different methods. And, you know, when people say, what's the thing of success to you? I say, well, 1.2 million people have our product and feel as a result because we're a very emotionally driven business. And if I could get to 20 million, that would be amazing, yeah. You know, because that would make me feel there's 20 million there who feel good about themselves, who love themselves, you know, and who that sign of loving yourself is all around this happiness and unstressful. But let's get into unstress. I love, because what I really want to get from you, in the book you have action. It's a handbook. You are a man after my own heart. It's a handbook. It's a lovely read. Alice, your co-author, is more from, I would say, the heart chakra psychological yes. aspect, and you're from more the manual practical. Here's some anonyms. What is it called when it's like gym and all these different ones? But yeah. I'd love to just get deep now. Everyone, get out your pen and paper. I mean, you can buy the book, or just if you have the book already, start underlining. Of things which people can grab. So let's say there's somebody listening here, Mo, and they're feeling fearful. I'd love to just talk about those five things, the way you break down anxiety, fear, you know, those five, and look at the different ways, because I learned so much when I was listening to you talking about that. Yeah. So can we start with that?
Absolutely, let's start with that. So I think the basic understanding, so unstressable is a promise, that it's not an attempt to de-stress you. That would be a futile event, you know, because basically, if I de-stress you now, tomorrow you're going to come back and
yeah, it's like band-aiding.
Yeah. The unstressable was a promise by me and Alice, who both have struggled with serious stress in our life. Mm-hmm. Alice probably more than I. That there is a way to go through the shittiest patches of life and completely be okay. Now, you don't believe this, just question yourself, huh? Because things that freaked me out when I was 20, I handled them when I was 30. I, you know, handled them with ease when I was 40, and I laughed about them when I was 50. Okay? The same event, but somehow there is a relationship to how you deal with it. So it's not the event of your life that stresses you. It is the way you deal with it that does.
So the knowledge of time, to bring that back down to people who are 20 so they wouldn't have to go through that is a secret sauce to me.
Correct. So yeah. So the idea is, can we get what you learn over time with the bashing of life and teach you that up front so that you don't feel that you're bashed at all, right? And so you can also, by the way, see that clearly in physics. So when Alice and I are the yin and yang, truly. I mean, it's not that we're opposites, but the personas of us in this book are very, very different. Alice is the spiritual, emotional, feminine, very soft approach to stress. I'm the very logical, practical, analytical approach to stress. And that mix, I believe, is really fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoy listening to her as much as she enjoys listening to me. The thing, however, is that, so my approach to stress started from physics. When Alice said, let's write about stress, I said, ooh, I know stress. In physics, stress is not the force applied to you. It's not the challenge that you face. It's the force divided by the cross section of the object that's carrying that force. Right?
So meeting together, not pushing.
If you apply a force to one pencil, it may break, right? But if you apply it to 20 pencils, the square area of the 20 pencils of the cross section is bigger.
So
it can carry the force more, right? Yeah. And so in humans, it's the same. It's the challenges that you face divided by your resources, your abilities, your skills. And so there are clearly mathematically two ways. One is to reduce the challenges that you face, which is sometimes within our hands. Most of the time it isn't.
Not, yeah.
But it's also about building those skills. And so we started to say, to start, is stress a bad thing? And you know that executive on the cover of a Harvard Business Review with striped suit and grumpy and like, stress is the best way for people to achieve. No, it's not, right? There is creativity, there is playfulness, there is flow. There are so many other ways you can achieve that don't have to stress you.
Yeah.
A little bit of stress is good.
But too much. And cortisol for me, which is a pet subject, which we release, the more stressed we are, there is only 10% is positive, the rest is negative.
Correct. Yeah. It is designed as a survival mechanism. You're supposed to have cortisol in your blood for a very short period, for a very short period of time to become superhuman, to overcome a challenge. Mm-hmm. And then you have to unwind and go back into parasympathetic state and become comfortable and rested again, right? How do you make sure that cortisol works for you and not against you is the topic of this, right? And we basically said there are three different ways a human will break under stress.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't break, we're doing really well. Mm-hmm. If you feel a little stressed by the presentation on Thursday, so you work a little harder, fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to make sure happens is that you don't break because you're stressed by the presentation, then stressed by the dinner, then stressed by the conversation with your partner, then stressed by the presentation the next day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Three ways where we break. One is trauma. Okay, let's come back and talk about this. The second is burnout.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is what you're talking about, is the idea of the anticipation of a challenge.
The anxiety.
So I call it fear and all of its derivatives.
Yeah.
Right? And we all have fear. Fear is a survival mechanism. It appears extremely irrational, but it isn't at all.
Mm-hmm.
Fear is a highly predictable algorithmic emotion. Fear is the result of a moment in the future is less safe than this moment.
Yeah.
It's very simple. You take. I'm on the sidewalk, the platform.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I step into the street. A car is approaching me. I am now less safe than I was on the platform. I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Very simple. Okay. When you're afraid, you try to deal with the challenge. That's that's the correct human response.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is when we deal with worry, anxiety, and panic the same way we deal with fear. And that's why they linger and they're never resolved, right? So worry is not like fear. Worry is not that a moment in the future is less safe than now. Worry is I suspect. I'm not sure, okay? I keep oscillating back and forth between is it not safe or is it safe? Is it not safe or is it safe, right? And when you're worried, if you try to address the fear, like let's take an example. I'm worried I will lose my job, okay? If you address it as fear, you will, give up on this job, try to look for another job, start saving. You'll behave as if the threat is about to happen.
Yeah.
Okay?
But it's only a worry at this
But
stage.
It's only a worry. So your mind starts to go back and say, but what if I don't lose my job?
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for other jobs. Why am I doing this? Maybe I should invest in this one and double down and make my manager like me more. Right? And that oscillation.
So you need to So when you have worry, you should challenge.
When you have worry, decide.
Well, you challenged to begin with before you decided.
Yeah, right.
You have to have that moment in between.
It builds up. You have to challenge yourself and decide. Decide, should I be afraid or should I chill? Right?
Okay.
If the answer is no, hold on, the probability of the fear happening is not that high, then chill it, drop it, don't even think about it.
Yeah.
Right? If you decide, hold on, no, that's actually high probability, then treat it as fear.
And then confront it.
And confront.
Okay. So it's just, that's one decision. Okay. So I get your thing of the decision. You have to make this decision. Is it below the 50 or above the 50?
Exactly. And, or by the way, if it's difficult logically to make that decision, pick one.
Yeah.
But stick to it.
Okay. Like, so the mother saying, I worry my son is never going to get married.
Great. Right, so you have one of two choices, either to tell yourself, first of all, how often do sons not get married? Is my son really not going to get married? Whatever. You can decide and say, yep, my son is not going to get married. I might as well find a way to make sure that I live with that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I address the challenge. Or, hold on, come on. He's so cute. He's so attractive. All the girls like
Logic him. Prevails.
Yeah. And then you tell yourself, maybe I shouldn't be worried about it.
Chill.
Right?
Okay.
So chill or be afraid.
That's with your worry.
Yeah.
All right.
Anxiety is even more interesting. So the topic of worry is uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
If you handle it as fear, you're screwed,
yeah.
Right? The topic of anxiety, interestingly, is not the challenge. The topic of anxiety is, I do not feel capable of addressing the challenge.
Yeah.
I am aware of the challenge. It's centered around me. I don't feel good enough.
Yeah.
Okay?
It's not shame, but it's nothing to do with outside things.
It has nothing to do with the challenge. So I have a presentation on Thursday, right? And I feel challenged is not the issue. I feel that I'm not going to be able to be up to the challenge is the issue. Now, if you address that by trying to work on the challenge, nothing will happen. You have to address that by working on yourself.
Mm.
So number one, you decide. You look at the situation. Mm. You say, "But I've handled 20 presentations before. It's okay."
Yeah.
Right? Or to present to one of your friends and say, "Is this good enough?" Right.
Yeah.
Or to basically say, "Oh, no, hold on. Actually, I am not qualified. So I'm either going to dedicate the time to learn the financial bit that I'm not ready for, or maybe I'll get a friend that will help me with the financial bit, or whatever." But the focus of anxiety is capability. It's not the fear. It's not what I'm afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
Am I capable of dealing with it?
So in a situation of anxiety, as opposed to worry, which one would you think, let me just have a little meditation or take time out, and which one wouldn't you do that in?
Anxiety for sure requires you to both of them require
calm.
Reflection,
yeah,
right? But anxiety is a lot more pervasive because you've decided that the challenge is happening.
Yeah,
okay?
And it hasn't really happened yet.
It hasn't,
but you've brought it in.
You've decided that it's happening, and you've decided that you're not good enough to handle it, right? This is the worst situation ever. It's almost like saying, I am on a train, and the train is on a collision course, right? And you're like, and I don't have the ability to jump off the train or to stop the train.
Yeah.
That kind of thought
is
really, really, really ingrained in you. It's very, very powerful. Mm? The question is, how true is it? 99% of the time, your biggest fears never happened. Okay?
Yeah.
And the 1% of the time that they happened, you're still here.
Mm-hmm.
You handled it.
Mm-hmm.
You survived it somehow. And that's really the question. The question is, can you actually be objective around, can I really deal with this? If I can, why am I anxious?
Yeah.
Okay? And by the way, if I can't, there's no point wasting time obsessing about it. The objective in that case is dedicate your time to becoming better at handling it, right? Panic is the third one. Panic, again, confuses us. Why? Because panic is not about the thing we're afraid of. Panic is about time. It's a question of time.
Yeah.
We panic when the threat is imminent.
Yeah.
The closer we get to the threat, the more we panic.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the presentation is on Thursday. If it's Sunday today, you're less panicked than if it's Wednesday today.
Yeah.
Okay. And again, don't solve the challenge. Solve the time issue. Tell yourself, okay, I have 4 days to do this. It doesn't feel like enough time. Maybe I should cancel other meetings. Maybe I should get someone to help me.
But there's action to take.
And that I think is one of the biggest messages of Unstressable. One of the biggest messages of Unstressable is there is action to take.
Now, how do you feel when you think of Ali now?
Losing someone you love, the pain never goes away. I don't know if you would agree, but anytime Ali would come to my heart, I'd miss him, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there is a big difference between pain and suffering. Pain is what comes from outside you or what comes from your circumstances, okay? And pain is useful, believe it or not. Mm? Pain is, you cut your finger, you pull your hand back to keep it safe, right? The thing, interestingly, is if you take that example, you realize that once your finger heals a little, your body stops making you feel the pain. It might not be fully healed yet, but as long as it's safe now, your body will stop the pain. That's not the case with emotional pain. With emotional pain, we choose to regenerate it on demand. I call it the Netflix of unhappiness.
Yeah.
Right? We choose to take the moment where Ali was in the intensive care unit, and we take that photograph and put it up in our memory and say, how can that happen to my son?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it feels involuntary, but it isn't. You have a choice. I never actually shared this ever in my life. When Ali was in the intensive care unit, I took a photograph of him. Okay? Basically, after the doctor said Ali's going to die. So the doctor basically said his most of his organs have failed. If he comes back to life, he's going to be a vegetable. So, you know, we don't know what to do, but we don't think he's going to make it. So I took one final photo of them, of him. And in my mind, I was like, I don't know if I want this or I don't, but this is the very last physical image of my son. Mm-hmm. The next morning, for some strange reason, my phone shows up a very weird message, okay? And I have to, like, switch off and go back to factory settings and whatever, knowing for a fact that my photographs are backed up. Mm-hmm. I switch the phone back on after the restoration of my photos. That one photo is not there. It's almost as if life's telling me, why? Why would you want to remember the moment where Ali was dying?
I have to tell you, which I haven't talked about, when Johnny was dead and his coffin was open and I didn't know it was down the end of my road whether I should go, I went and everyone had gone and I took a picture and I didn't know whether I should take that picture. And the picture was not on my phone.
Yeah.
So I took the picture and I thought, I won't look, and I could never find the picture.
I know. Is it? Why? Why would you want that to be the last memory of him? Why?
Well, a power greater than yourself is not letting you have that as a last memory of Ali.
Correct.
Or of Johnny.
100%. This is almost the kindness of the universe. Because I'll tell you very openly, whenever... I know that for a fact, as it's your case. Almost four times a week, almost, you know, three times when I wake up or when I'm with a conversation with someone or whatever, my brain brings almost an autonomous thought. It says Ali died, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the most painful thought a father could ever have. It's confusing on so many levels. It's painful on so many levels, but it's true. I learned around 5 days in, when my brain told me this, to respond and say, yeah, brain, Ali died, thanks for hurting me. But Ali also lived. Ali lived is the same exact fabric. He couldn't have died if he hadn't lived. And by the way, Ali came into my life with another total stroke of luck. Right? We didn't plan for Ali. We didn't expect Ali. We didn't even want children at the time. And shows up this beautiful blessing for 21 and a half years, right? And somehow my brain manages to constantly say Ali died and forgets to say Ali lived. Now, if you really want to look deep at the reality of life, Ali lived is the core thought. Ali lived is all the games we played together, all the jokes we said, all the music we played together, all the topics we pondered together where he taught me enormous things, all the love that I felt. That is the story. This is the story. And when you really, really think deeply about it, and I know it's crazy to say that, every time I think about it, I say to myself, I'll take the pain of losing him 100 times. Because the alternative was that he didn't come in the first place. Now, we tend to choose to kill ourselves. We tend to choose pain and suffering. The loss of Ali is pain. The suffering is for me to keep telling myself Ali died instead of Ali lived. Mm. The suffering is for me to ignore all of the blessings that came when Ali lived. The suffering is for me to ignore the fact that I too will die. You see, this is the most interesting part of this. Despite what faith you have, or if you don't believe there is anything after this, I have more certainty that I will be where Ali will be than I have that I will live another minute. That's the truth of our life.
Yeah.
Okay? And so can we, for a change, look at our lives and say, hey, I am really grateful I had that enormous joy that you gave me by being in my life, Ali. And I hope you're doing well wherever you are, because I will be there soon too. And I know it sounds really, really difficult when I say it so simplistically, but you know what the alternative is? The alternative is I hit my head against the wall, I cry and kill myself for 27 years, and then on my deathbed, he's not there still. And then I end up where he is. Mm. How smart is that? It's a choice, believe it or not.
Yeah.
It is a choice, what we tell ourselves in our head. It's a
How
choice.
How long did it take you, Mo, to get to the place where you could look at it like that?
To me, I was lucky again, I think. So when Ali left our world, I was chief business officer of Google X at the time. Believe it or not, I was still an employee of Dubai. So I always worked from Dubai. And so I was very heavily connected in Dubai. And the news traveled very, very, very fast. Within around a couple of hours, I received a call from a very senior government official saying, Mo, I heard, I'm really, really sorry, but I promise you we'll get to the bottom of this. And then he asked and said, would you mind if we performed an autopsy on Ali's body? And Nibel, my ex, my wife then, was sitting next to me. So I looked at her. Of course, you can imagine how her heart was at the time. I looked at her and I said, Nibel, do you mind if they perform an autopsy on Ali's body? And she raises her head very slowly with a tear on her cheek and says, will it bring Ali back? Why would I do this? Would it bring Ali back? I want my son to just move to his next journey. Okay? And when they teach you about grief, they tell you there are five stages of grief.
Mm.
You start from all of the denial and you end up in acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? When Nibel said this, we both got anchored in acceptance. It's like, look, you don't have a choice.
Mm.
You see, acceptance is quite an interesting mindset. Hmm? Because the minute someone you love dies, you've accepted physically. It's done.
Mm.
You have no choice. You're stuck in it for the rest of your life with the pain of, you know, losing them, with the pain of missing them. It's there, right? Your job is to accept in your mind. Your job is to let your mind accept it. And then comes a million crazy thoughts. Like I had the thought of, I drove him to the hospital where he lost his life. A parent's guilt, okay? You know, in the case of suicide, you have the questioning of,
what could I have done more?
What could I have done more? Mm-hmm. And you can end in those for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Unresolved. And even if resolved, they don't change a thing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't change a thing. Hmm?
Mm.
And so interestingly, you know, you and I know in business, it's so easy to do this. You lose a deal or,
you move on.
You look at it and you go like, okay, what can I do to make life better right now?
Yeah.
Okay? And that's committed acceptance. Committed acceptance is to say, Ali left.
Mm-hmm.
I wish life was different.
Hmm? Mm-hmm.
But what can I do to make my life and the life of those I care about today better than yesterday and tomorrow better than today? And once you do that, you start to do miracles, honestly. So I get up 17 days later and I write what he taught me. Become Soul for Happy, international bestseller everywhere, changing the lives of people. It doesn't bring Ali back, but it makes life better.
Yeah.
And I think that's the game. The game of stress, the game of unhappiness, the game of all of the challenges, the relationship challenges, the work challenges, the life challenges are all because we choose to address them in a way that is not in our own benefit.
Mm. There isn't one aspect of what we've discussed today which isn't around fear, actually, in a way, because...
This is Alice's work, which I love. You know, there are lots of layers to emotions, okay? The beginning of the chapter, I think she called it Feel to Heal.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I jumped in and I said, no, Alice, emotions are triggered by thoughts and logic, which is mostly true, right? Most emotions are algorithmic. Envy is,
But what about that feeling in the pit of your stomach? That's not algorithmic.
So the way emotions are triggered, quite interestingly, in nature, where we didn't have social media and everything else, was a very visceral response. Mm-hmm. Like a tiger shows up, right? Your amygdala detects it. Your amygdala is almost the closest part of your brain to your reptilian brain. It's right next to the to the brain stem.
The most sort of intuitive.
It's like a lizard.
Fight or flight. Yeah.
So it detects it. It produces, you know, instructs your brain to produce the, CHT is the hormone cocktail basically that triggers your adrenal gland on top of your kidneys to release cortisol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. cortisol basically reconfigures your body to be superhuman.
Yeah.
For 90 seconds. That's it. Within 90 seconds, all of the hormones are flushed from your body. And that's when your prefrontal cortex and you know, your logical brain basically engages to verify if there is a tiger or not.
Okay.
Now, the problem with our modern world is that this is not the cycle. The cycle is triggered from your prefrontal cortex. You're triggered from a thought, not from a tiger. You think of a tiger. Okay?
Okay.
And so when you go back 90 seconds later, you go like, nothing changed. My thought is exactly the same.
Yeah.
You have not debated it. You haven't seen if it's right or wrong. And so you're renewing the lease of the hormone.
Yeah.
Sometimes for 90 years. Okay? Mm-hmm. And that is the issue. The issue is, you know, when you really think about it, fear is an emotion that, like I said, it's an emotion that says a moment in the future is less safe than now.
Yeah.
So your fear is directly proportionate to your state of safety now minus your state of safety at T1.
Yeah.
Okay, it's algorithmic.
Yeah.
It doesn't appear algorithmic. It appears irrational, but it follows logic. It follows some kind of a predictable behavior, right? You can take those emotions and, you know, there is a ton of research, you know, Brené Brown, for example, says 87 emotions. You know, some research will say 6 main emotions, but then there is an emotions wheel where you can blend them and do, you know, all of the sort of art that you can do to create other emotions.
Yeah.
The most beautiful work, I actually don't remember the name of the author, A Course in Miracles.
Yeah, Mary Beth Williams.
Yeah, I don't remember. But basically, the book basically says that all of those, however, stem from only two emotions, love and fear.
Mm.
And basically, if you get that, you suddenly realize that it's so interesting how impactful fear is into our life and how our biological machine is entirely geared around survival and fear. And so, you know, jealousy is, I am afraid I will lose my partner because another is taking my partner from me. I'm afraid I'm going to lose part of my partner or their attention or whatever. Envy is, I'm afraid I'm not going to, you know, survive in life because I don't have what others have.
Good as,
right? And so on. And so when you really understand that, fear, and, you know, we're talking about fearless, is a very exaggerated emotion. Fear is, interestingly, your brain trying to get your attention, and then when it doesn't get the attention, it lies.
To reinforce the anxiety level.
Yeah, you see, a mother's heart would not accept if her child caught the flu twice, you know, in winter. So what would she tell the husband? She would say, your son's been sick all winter. All winter is a massive exaggeration.
Yeah.
Okay? But you know, if the statement is your son was sick for 6 days this winter, that doesn't formulate something that's urgent enough to take action. So it's always exaggerated, always exaggerated. And I always say that fear, in Solve for Happy, I wrote what is normally, you know, what I normally refer to as the interrogation. Okay, there are 6 questions you go through to remind your brain if your fear is warranted, if the reason behind it is true, what's the worst that can happen? Can I handle it? What's the best that can happen if I face my fear? Okay? And what does it take to face my fear?
Okay.
Now, more interestingly...
So let's repeat those so people can remember.
You know, what's the reality of your fear? Is it warranted?
Yeah.
Okay? Is it true?
Yeah.
What's the worst that can happen? Can I handle it?
Yeah.
Okay? What is the best that can happen? And how do I get to that?
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, most interestingly of those in total is the question of, is it true? Right? Is it true, like you said, 90% of our fears never come true. If your worst fears came true, you wouldn't be here.
So how do we define if it's true, if our brain is not us, and that fear is voiced by something that is not us?
So my the story I frequently use is, when Ali died, Ali, for years before he died, became the masculine figure in Aya's world. He was such an amazing man. And I was busy working, providing, as they...
How old was Aya at the time?
I was almost 20. Ali was 21 and a half. Mm-hmm. And somehow I trusted him so much. Of course, never expected he would leave. Mm-hmm. So I basically said, he's a better masculine figure than me. Let him be in our life. Mm-hmm. When he died, it took me around 9 months to recognize the gap. Okay, and I was in a very bad relationship then because of Ali's departure. And it just hit me that, my God, my daughter doesn't have a masculine energy in her life. Mm-hmm. She lived in Montreal at the time, and I lived in California. I didn't live in California, I lived between California. I worked in California sometimes, and I was in Dubai. And I kept shuttling back and forth every other week. Somehow I decided the only way, of course, a 20-year-old doesn't want daddy in her life. Mm-hmm. So I basically made up the story that I have work in Montreal. Mm-hmm. Okay? And on my shuttling back to Dubai, I would spend the weekend in Montreal. You know, arrive on a Friday. And
pretend
then
to do your work.
And yeah, I have work, baby. And I would text her mm-hmm. and say, babe, I'm here. I have work. I'm going to be a little busy, but I'd love to take you out shopping or maybe dinner or whatever. The first few times, she would ignore me completely and then text me a couple of hours before I leave and say, hey, do you want a coffee? And we'd have a coffee. Mm-hmm. A few weeks later, she would start to say, why are you staying at the end of the other end of the city? Come, there is a hotel four blocks away. Then she would say, oh, no, but there is an Airbnb in the building. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then there was one day where she said, the apartment at the other end of my floor is now empty. Shall we rent it and use it as an Airbnb if you're not here? Immediately, I said yes. Okay.
And I How long did this take?
Around 14 months.
Yeah.
Consistently. Mm. And I will tell you what happened. Huh? I would wake up. My kitchen window looked at her kitchen window. Mm-hmm. Okay. I had never once knocked her door for those 14 months. Total privacy. She lives whatever she wants. She does whatever mm-hmm. she wants. Mm-hmm. But in the morning, once her kitchen light goes on, I would text and say, baby, I'm making pancakes and your favorite milkshake. Do you want to come over? Okay. Sometimes I get a yes. Sometimes I get a no. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we were getting closer and closer and closer to that bond, if you mm-hmm. want. Mm-hmm. One day, on your question of how do you deal with your brain, one day we are having breakfast. Hmm? She's the one that texted me and said, hey, I want to make you breakfast. Come over. I miss you. Okay? I walked in. She hugged me and said, I love you so much. Thank you for being here. How is work? Right? And then we started to talk about the silliest thing ever, which is it good to have millions of songs on Spotify or not? Mm-hmm. Okay? And in my view, I was like, this is too many. I mean, I love maybe 1,000 songs, and it's more than enough. In her point of view, she's an artist. This is empowering artists to put their art out there. Mm-hmm. And we argued about it. So I basically say, baby, this is, why are we arguing about this? Let me go have a coffee. I'll come back, and we can talk about something else. The minute I walk out of the building, my brain says, Aya doesn't love you anymore. Mm-hmm. Okay? So I kid you not, I stopped in the middle of the streets of Montreal like a maniac, like mm-hmm. a madman, which is okay in Montreal, by the way. And I out loud said, what the fuck did you just say? How can you give yourself the right, my
to
brain?
To go from Spotify thing to she doesn't love you.
And to destroy my life in the process. Mm-hmm. Because she's my life. Mm-hmm. At the time, she was still is. Hmm?
Yeah.
She was the only purpose of my life at the time was mm-hmm. to fix that relationship. Mm-hmm. Okay, top purpose. Hmm? And my brain can hijack it in a second by giving you one thought. Oh, she doesn't love you anymore. I literally take out my phone. I look at my WhatsApp. I say, count the kisses. Okay, count the emojis of hugs and loves. Remember how she hugged you when you walked in. How can you say that, brain? Give me evidence, right? Of course, total silence. Mm-hmm. The brain's like, I'm so sorry. I shouldn't be doing that again. And it never did that again. Mm. Remember, the idea is my brain is panicking. My daughter, that is so important for me, we're having an argument. It's I understand, brain, that you're panicking, but mm-hmm. don't suggest crap, okay? And that relationship with your brain is what matters most, because most of the time, all that your brain wants, which makes you miserable, is to make you safe.
What do you think Ali's brain had told her that led to your breakdown of your relationship with her?
Nothing. She just had sufficient masculine energy in her life.
Yeah, but she had Ali,
mm-hmm.
and he died. And you took a long time to get to a place of closeness to her. So there must have been a period of separation.
Yeah, I mean, I started 9 months after he left,
mm.
4 years after he became the prominent figure in her life. I'm a stranger. You know, I am a provider, basically,
which is
what most parents fall into, remember?
Yeah. So at 16,
mm-hmm.
she's getting more from her brother emotionally,
yes.
and she's getting rent paid by you.
Correct.
Okay,
and
you're
understand.
You're the cash point, and he's the emotional support.
Yeah, and of course, being the cash point, I realize now, leaves her with lots of messages that I didn't send. Like, he's not interested, he's busy, he's looking at other things in his life. Right? Around that time as well, I mean, my relationship with my ex was not great.
Yeah.
Eventually we separated very, very peacefully and lovingly.
Yeah.
We're still very
but
good
she
friends.
She was close to her mother.
But she suddenly is now saying, oh, and he's leaving us. Right?
Yeah.
And all of that comes into place. And,
yeah.
and remember, again, I mean, you can look back at this and blame yourself. Or you can look back at self. You see, I find that regret is the most stupid of all emotions.
So I agree.
Yeah, it's like if I gave you the same exact information set and the same skill set that you had when you made the last decision, you'll make the same decision again.
Yeah.
Why are you blaming yourself, right? You can regret that you didn't learn, but you can't regret that you took a certain decision, okay? And I say that publicly because I will tell you openly. I'm again, masculine man, big beard, bald, right? There's nothing more valuable in your life than the love of those that you love.
Mm.
There's nothing more valuable, okay? You can tell yourself, oh, I'm out there making a billion people happy. Crap. If you're making a billion people happy and failing your daughter, you're a worthless piece of shit.
Mm.
It's as simple as that. Hmm? The trick here is nobody makes decisions to destroy anything. You know, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to mess up today and upset
no,
a few people.
It goes back to the happy baby thing. I could speak to you for hours and hours. I feel we should do another whole series on a different element, and it's not called Fearless, and I'm thinking of another podcast already. But it was, God, it's been a joy talking to you.
Same here. Thank you so much.
I've loved it. I can't wait to now read this from cover to cover, having just dipped in. And I just want to say that Alice, I would love to meet at some stage and have her on too.
Absolutely.
Your co-writer in this book. But
Alice it's really the yin and yang. It would be such an enriching experience to hear that from her point of view.
And you have masterclasses on Maestro.
I do. And we have unstressable.com actually. So the million people out of stress every year.
Yeah.
It's not just the book. Books don't go that far very
quickly.
Yeah. Our biggest effort actually is unstressable.com.
So you go on and you sign up and say, I'm going to be one of these people.
So unstressable.com is a community where we have a video library of all of the training that you need to do. So people who don't like to read, believe it or not, reading is not the biggest activity nowadays.
Yeah.
So it's available in video format. And then we do our monthly webinar
where
for corporates, we do a monthly, for individuals, do every quarter. And we spend 2.5 hours together talking about stress in all the different ways. But there is also the community element where people work together to support each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we get quite a few guest speakers and so on. But the game here is that, you know, stress as a skill, believe it or not, I don't want to sell the book short. It's really not that difficult. Okay? It's the intention to dedicate yourself to becoming unstressful. Right, and once you put in that intention, like going to the gym, the first few days or weeks will be difficult, but once you get the skills
and you see the reward,
it starts to become second nature.
Mm.
So that's how it's how it is.
Well, I can't wait for everyone else to read it, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Tulsima. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Where do I start, really? Because this is a dream guest for me, Mo Goddard, because it's the ultimate discussion about fear. And practical applications to look at how we can deal with fear in our lives, to break it down, to look at, is it worry? Is it anxiety? Is it panic? Is it trauma? You know, and I've got to just say, I've never been promoting a book as much as I'm going to promote this book, but it's really good. And I've looked at excerpts from it and seen and read Mo's other books, and you just come away with these chunks of knowledge and give you exercises that you can actually use practically in your life. So if you're feeling that you have this fear in your life and you've been listening to the podcast to be inspired to look at how we can deal with fear in our life, I think this has taught me so much. And I wrote so many notes on my iPad preparing for this interview. And I remembered so much of what he'd said, which shows me how much it went in, which shows me how relevant it is to my life. So I really hope that it's relevant to some things that you are going through as well at the moment. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. And if you've listened to a few now and you feel that you leave learning something, please share that with your friends so more people can listen. It helps us grow our audience, it helps us get fabulous guests, and it spreads a message of how to be fearless in your life.